And on RN, you're listening to Book Snarts Daily this Monday morning with Michael Cathcart. Well, piracy, illegal copying, bootlegging, they're hardly new. In fact, you probably remember going to a market and seeing stalls of music cassettes or CDs and DVDs, and the bloke says, oh, of course they're real, they're the genuine article, but you look at them and you can see that the cover's been put through a colour photocopier. You know they're dodgy. Well, with advancing technology, illegal copying, the sharing of music and films, and now books, has become a whole lot easier. At the click of a mouse, you can access the world's e-books. And it doesn't take much know-how to work out ways to make duplicates of those books. Novelist and scriptwriter Matt Rubenstein discusses what this means for the copyright of authors and publishers in the September issue of Australian Book Review. And Matt joins me now on the line from Cambridge, where he's living at the moment. Welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So, copyright has protected the rights of authors and publishers pretty much since the dawn of printing. How did it come about?
Well, copyright sort of came about with the dawn of printing. Before that, copyright had not been a huge issue for authors because books, of course, were fantastically expensive to create, produce, even if you didn't have to make up the story in the first place. You had to organise a scribe and parchment and everything. It's very expensive. The introduction of the movable type printing press in the 15th century suddenly made it much easier for commercial pirates in particular to copy books for much less than it cost to produce the original, so they could get an advanced copy often of a manuscript, set it to type just about at the same time as the official version came out, and it would be flooding the streets of London before you knew it. That led over a couple of centuries to the very first Copyright Act, which was the Statute of Anne in the early 18th century. Which pretty much solved the problem by making the copying of books illegal, and there were various bodies set up to police that too.
The marvellously named Statute of Anne, named after Queen Anne. It wasn't just that the person who wrote it was naming it after his little girl or something, but Queen Anne was on the throne. So publishers got into the act first, didn't they? In the 1500s, the publishers received some sort of protection that looked a bit like copyright, and then authors were brought into the picture under the Statute of Anne.
That's right, yep.
So the Statute of Anne is 1710, and pretty much that's how things continued until quite recently. So what's changed?
What's changed is really the development of electronic books and the increasing sophistication of electronic readers. Probably about 15 years ago that I was first asked to talk about the future of the book. At that time, people were talking about books being distributed on CD-ROM and read on your laptop screen, which was sort of very low contrast, black and white. And I took a very firm position that the future of the book was in no danger.
It was about that time that I acquired a CD, CD, that had the world's classics on it. And I reckon there were, I don't know, there were 700 books or something on one CD. And I thought, this will be great. I'll be able to read Thucydides and Herodotus and Mark Twain. I didn't read any of them. It was very unpleasant.
Well, yeah, it was very unpleasant. But just over the last, over the last 5 years, I think electronic readers have become much more pleasant to use. They're not exactly like books, but they're at least like pages. To look at them now is like to look at a printed page. As the resolution gets higher, as the contrast gets better, as the devices themselves get lighter. As I say in the essay, a lot of people that that thought they would never read a book on a computer screen, including myself, were really just limited by the available technology at the time and what a computer screen was. Now, of course, we read things on computer screens all day, and as they approach some sort of parity with the printed page, people are appreciating the convenience, the ability to download a book pretty much as soon as you think of it, and to carry your whole library around with you.
Well, that's not of itself a good thing or a bad thing. That's just a change in the way we read books. But
that's right.
But the issue is that books have started turning up on those file sharing sites where you can download things for free.
That is the issue. As people's attention moves away somewhat from the printed book, the physical book, to the story, the words on the page, the soul of the book, as I say in the essay, that sort of thing is much easier to copy than a physical book is. You can't at home make a copy of a book that you have, but you can very easily copy with 100% fidelity the electronic book that you or someone else has downloaded.
So, Matt, do we have any figures on this to give a sense of the scale of this practice?
The figures are pretty rubbery. It's been said that that book piracy cost $2.8 billion. I think it was 2009 were the last figures, but I personally don't really believe those figures. I think they're quite unsophisticated figures. What you can see is that almost every book that's released now is available on the internet right away, if not before. And it's up to us, I think, to try and protect ourselves the best way we can, which I think is not by necessarily doubling down on policing piracy, but by making it convenient and attractive for people to buy books through legitimate channels.
Do you mean by e-books through legitimate channels?
That's right, yeah.
I mean, it occurs to me that one of the great potential markets for e-books is students. I mean, I built my student library out of secondhand books because that's all I could afford. I haunted secondhand bookshops, so no publisher or author ever made any money out of my reading habits, and I had lots and lots and lots of books. But this generation of students can't afford to buy books because they're e-books and they're that much cheaper, and what's more, they won't have a storage problem. No more bookcases made out of bricks and planks. So maybe, you know, the next generation of literate students will be inclined to buy e-books in the way they download music and everything else.
Well, that's the hope. If we get the pricing of e-books right, I think, which is still a matter of contention, that's a great potential market. These kids are much used to reading books on computer screens. They're much more savvy, and they're used to purchasing things off the internet too. They've been trained by the online music stores and video rental services. So I think it is a great market. I mean, while we're over here in Cambridge, I've bought a lot more electronic books than physical books, partly because of the money, but less so, more because of the space that's required. We've got a small student flat, and it's already full of the books that we brought with us. There's no more room to buy new books. And so it was really coming here, being in this new situation, that kick-started my e-book buying habit.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're talking to Matt Rubenstein, playwright, screenwriter, novelist, man about town, who's living in Cambridge for a couple of years because his wife's there doing a PhD. Look, what do you reckon are the fair limits of copyright in terms of duration? In December last year, some of the heavies of British music took out a full-page ad calling for the extension of copyright in sound recordings. They wanted it to go up from 50 years to 95 years in the UK, which does raise the question, how long is long enough? I mean, there is an argument that there comes a moment when it's healthy for art to pass into the public sphere. Art nourishes art. Eventually, everyone should be able to have a go at Yellow Submarine or Catch 22, just as they can play Vivaldi or do adaptations of the Iliad.
I agree completely. Under the Statute of Anne, a writer got 14 years of copyright, which they could extend once if they took action to do so, but otherwise it would just pass into the public domain, which was kind of the idea of the whole thing. It was to strike a balance between people that wanted to create art, which always relies on previous art, and people being properly rewarded for their artistic efforts.
So it was yours for 28 years max.
Yes, that's right.
Under the old system. I mean, I suppose my gut feeling is that it now goes on a bit long. You know that film about a boy based on the Nick Hornby novel, and Hugh Grant plays this rich layabout in London who's able to be a rich layabout solely because his father wrote a rather irritating pop song for which Hugh Grant receives royalties all the time. And you just think, well, why? Why is he receiving royalties? He didn't write the song.
That's right. And there might be an argument for being able to provide for your children, but then the way that copyright works now is that it's your grandchildren or great-grandchildren that can control your copyright interests long after you're gone, which I think is a shame, particularly now that the people that benefit most from copyright over that length of time aren't people at all. They're corporations, and more corporations own the copyright in things.
You know, I mean, it is odd to me that people can own the copyright in Superman more or less in perpetuity. It seems to me like someone owning the rights to Zeus. There ought to come a moment when we can all make Superman movies and, you know, make Superman plays because he's kind of crossed a line into the public sphere.
I agree. It does seem a great shame that that we can't do what we like with some of these very widespread, important cultural symbols.
Anyway, we're straying a bit from our brief here, Matt, because we're really here to talk about the copyright that hasn't run too long and how we protect authors and publishers. So can you see a way of protecting authors and publishers? I mean, are there some measures that can be put in place so that works are not reproducible, or some way of policing this activity?
I think it's very difficult to put the measures in place technological measures are generally quite easy to get around, which is the reason there are so many books on the internet illegally, that someone has worked out how to crack the digital rights management on them. It seems like there are very few DRM schemes that haven't been compromised quite quickly. DRM seems to do more to inconvenience the legitimate buyers of books than actual pirates. So it might stop you from...
DRM is, as you say, digital rights management.
Yeah.
So these are electronic measures, are they, that are there to try to stop you from copying things?
Yes, they basically encrypt your book and need a key to unlock them. But the key has to be present on every device that you have, and so they seem to be quite easy to work around. So what they'll do is they'll stop you from easily lending an electronic book to a friend or letting a family member read it. But they won't do much to prevent you from downloading it off the internet for free, because the pirates out there have worked out pretty quickly how to get around the protection measures.
Someone's already cracked the DRM.
Mm.
Now, Matt, you say in the article that there are some authors who actually think that having their books downloaded in this way is a good thing.
There are. Some authors see it as publicity, as building an audience. It's often said that the greatest impediment to an author, especially at the beginning, isn't piracy, it's obscurity. So no one knows who you are, no one's going to buy your work. The internet provides a great opportunity to reach a worldwide audience, but there are so many books out there that it's very difficult to cut through. And unless someone can recommend you personally or on their blog or to their friends, it's hard to make an impact. On the one side, you're going to lose a certain number of sales because people aren't buying your book, they're downloading it for free. On the other, more people are reading your book who might become future fans, recommend the book to their friends, and result in more legitimate sales on the other side of the ledger. And authors have, I think, more or less instinctively chosen that one is more important than the other. And some people like Neil Gaiman, like Cory Doctorow, and more authors, I think, are starting to consider that the additional publicity and the new readers are worth more than the lost sales.
Yeah, you quote Neil Gaiman as saying that he thinks that releasing a free digital copy of American Gods in 2001 increased actual sales by 300%.
And it's hard to know whether that's true. I mean, it's always hard to say exactly what has caused a bump in sales or whatever, but that's what Neil thinks, and I'd be inclined to believe it. Mm. I'm kind of on the side of people that think that that obscurity is more of a problem and that we shouldn't be making enemies of people that want to read our books.
No,
we shouldn't treat them like
anything
enemies.
But obscurity. I'm with you 100%. Whatever happens to us, Matt, don't let us become obscure. Now, just as we wind up, I see that you've decided to get into e-publishing yourself with your first, until now, unpublished novel called Death of the Author.
I have, yeah. I'd sort of got into it, but I was just interested in the whole scene from the beginning, how to put an e-book together, how they worked as digital artifacts, and then the marketing, the cover design, and the various ways that you can get it out there. So yeah, it's there on the Kindle store worldwide at the moment, and I chose it because it kind of pleased me that it's a book that's set and written in the late 90s, before all of this happened. It's very much involved with books and the physical nature of books, the printing of them, the type, the paper, the feeling people have about them. It's a world really before the internet became widespread, and so people are still sending faxes to each other and looking up things in the phone book. And it's sort of been languishing for a while now, but I read it again in the last year, and it gave me quite an interesting feeling of nostalgia. And I thought to publish it as an e-book has a certain irony that attracted me.
I don't think I'll ever hanker for the yellow pages. I do like looking things up on the computer. But are you a person who likes ultimately to read a novel on paper?
I think there's nothing like the feeling of reading a great book, beautifully produced and bound on paper. So I think my favourite reading experiences will always be high-quality paper books.
There's one thing that's better, and that is getting a book you've written yourself from the publisher. The smell of your own new book, that's a beautiful aroma.
Yeah, it is. One thing, I guess, about the move to digital books is that publishers are realizing, I think, that the beauty of a book is really important to selling physical books. And I think a lot of the books over the years have drifted down towards mediocrity, physically speaking. But books, I think, are much more beautiful in the last couple of years as a response to the competition from the electronic form. So we're seeing some great books being produced, and I hope that they continue to be.
Well, a high-quality bookshop is a beautiful place to be, and it's a beautiful place to be because it's full of those lovely books. Matt, we've got to stop. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Matt Rubenstein, novelist, playwright and screenwriter. And there's a link to Matt's article. It's in the September ABR, that's Australian Book Review, on our website.